This is The Conversation. It is episode 133 with Stephen Westfall, Brooklyn-based painter, art writer for Art in America, among other destinations, professor, advocate for painting, vis-a-vis the shark's teeth and Big Bang theories, among others. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Stephen's paintings and wall paintings in particular, which he's been doing recently. You can also find a link to his website, and you can link to the various social media outlets for this show. And let me know how I can make your stay more comfortable while you are here. The last episode, 132, was with Thomas McKelly, writer and artist, writer for Hyperallergic Weekend, where he's also an editor, and we cover the waterfront. And when it comes to art reviewing, we also introduce to many of you the artist Judith Bernstein, and we get into Pier Paolo Pasolini's work, which we have not done ever before on this show. And Thomas is a real gentleman. I think you will enjoy that conversation quite a lot. Go check it out. So Stephen and I have a rather spirited discussion about painting, abstraction, figuration, etc. I prime him on one of my prime questions, which is, how do you feel about abstraction these days, particularly vis-a-vis the marketplace? And he has a lot to say about that. Very peppy exchange. And yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. On the back end, I will tell you briefly about Dan Colon, super artist. In the meantime, let's get to that conversation with Stephen Westfall. Thank you very much for being here, and I will talk to you on the back end. Ciao for now. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm okay. Where were you coming from, Stephen?
Coming from, tonight was a heavy opening night with a number of my friends, the painter Elena Sisto, Gary Stefan, and Tony Fair. We're all opening tonight, so all within like a 4-block radius of each other. And then I was having dinner with a friend, dear friend, the painter Patricia Tribe. So we were, so it was just a, you know, and I just dropped her off, and as I was driving back, and she lives near me in Brooklyn.
What neighborhood are you in Brooklyn?
I'm in Red Hook.
Ah, interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
No wonder you could have a car.
What?
I said, no wonder you can have a car. Right?
Well, I'm from California. I grew up in California. I can't imagine not having a car.
Right.
That's a funny statement, because definitely for the first several years in New York, when I moved to New York in 1980 from Santa Barbara, and the subway system, my world was very narrow, whatever was on the subway. New York was so new that I couldn't imagine like even going out to the country or anything.
Right.
But now I got a car when I moved down to Tribeca from the East Village, partly because I had gotten this teaching. I'd been given this honorary chair, a distinguished chair, Colgate, in 1999. And I needed a car for being up, up in the Western Reserve. I mean, Colgate is about an hour from nowhere in upstate and Western New York, not even Western. I guess that Western New York in relation to the Adirondack. But you get to nowhere first, and then you drive for an hour, and then you're at Hamilton, New York.
How often did you have to go to Colgate when you're doing that gig?
Well, I was living up there for a chair, so I was a resident.
Right.
I taught, but then you had to have a car, and it had to be a Subaru
because
you were going to deal with, the winter up there. And so I got a Subaru at an auction, and I've never looked back.
And how's the parking in Red Hook?
For now, it's great. I'm in a big loft, pre-Civil War loft building.
And it comes with parking?
The building was built pre-Civil War. It was a cotton warehouse. And there, you can see the lot number still stenciled on the beam. But it's getting really expensive, and I'm probably going to have to move. But it comes with parking. comes with its own parking, which is really nice.
Well, let me to interject if I could. That's one of the drumbeat patterns of my early conversations with people in New York is what you just said a moment ago. I'm probably going to have to move, you know. So, you know, Brooklyn is in some parts, I know Williamsburg is the most often cited, but soon it'll be Greenpoint too. In some cases, more expensive than Manhattan, right? So, from what I understand,
yes.
In any case, it's
some
all
parts of Manhattan.
Right.
Yes.
In any case, it's all getting pretty expensive. So,
well, you have this going on in LA, I think, with certain neighborhoods becoming.
We do. It's not quite as extreme, but yes, we do indeed.
Where are you in LA?
I am on the west side, in a neighborhood called Mar Vista, which only people local to LA will probably know. But yeah. It's gotten a lot more expensive over the last 10 years. It's true. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
where would be your next logical moving point?
Well, probably some other place in Brooklyn, but possibly New Jersey. Because mm-hmm. I'm a professor at Rutgers it's really, they've got you coming and going. I pay New York State tax for the privilege of living in Brooklyn on my Rutgers salary.
Right.
So that's like an extra $10,000 a year. You know, it's like I can live cheaper in New Jersey. I'm hoping because all my social world is here, and it's just easier to conceive of coming into going to museums and shows from the standpoint of Brooklyn than it is, say, from Edison.
Right. But it may be just
infinitely more practical to become a Jersey guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you squint, if you take the state out and hold it up in silhouette and you squint, it looks like the kind of the opposite parenthesis of California anyway.
Right. Well, what is your landlord's policy towards and what is your rental situation as far as, protection, if any?
Oh, there's no protection anywhere anymore, unless you were grandfathered in like decades ago.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so my rent went up like something like 18% a year and a half ago.
Yikes.
And it will go up again. So, I mean, it's really, really is becoming very difficult. The Magic Shop, the great recording studio that had been in Soho for many years, just closed.
Mm.
And they're not even trying to move to Brooklyn. They're just giving up.
Right.
They're going to farming or something. We're at some kind of, perhaps a tipping point, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm senatorial age. I'm like 63, but a lot of my students, even many of whom are successfully, out of graduate school now and having, having shows and doing well. Everybody's like looking to homestead, move to Detroit or Newark or some parts or upstate. A lot of people are moving up to like Kingston.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there's quite a boom in the Hudson Valley of artists, towns and whatnot, right?
Yeah, I imagine, yeah. It's in the Hudson Valley, being in L.A., I don't think you have like a bird. It's like Ojai or something.
Right.
Except it's much more rustic.
Right.
So there's all this organic farming and bio, what do they call it when it's biodynamic?
Mm-hmm.
When it's all animal power. It's not even like, gas powered tractors. Farming, which is both supremely ethical, environmentally and tends to produce heirloom type vegetables. People are really getting into that. There are people that are actually giving up lives as artists to become farmers.
Right. Yeah.
And
I think that's
the Hudson Valley.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
I was going to say that actually is that's not an insignificant observation because, it kind of conflating with the sort of rental and survival situation, it's kind of a new paradigm. It's an example of a new paradigm where, I mean, on the other hand, I want to quickly go back before I lose that train of thought to the way you started describing how you had just come from these, the sequence of openings of all your friends of about your age, And that sounded so vintage to me. That sounded like New York of, you know, several decades ago. And it would be a shame to not have that opportunity anymore because you're in upstate New York or Jersey or wherever, you know?
Right. Well, most of us have done Exile, you know, it's beautiful upstate. But I think as artists, we're kind of always aware that it's hard not to be aware now that for any artist to move into any neighborhood or any town, we are the warning side of approaching gentrification.
Right.
Like the artist moves in and then the pour over coffee shop opens up because us artists are sensitive and we've got to have good coffee. And all of a sudden the property values are going up.
Yeah.
And either the poor people that are there or even the working class eventually get priced out.
Right.
It's happening in Rhinebeck upstate. It happened a little bit in Kingston.
Mm.
And it will happen in New Jersey, I imagine. I don't know where everybody's going. They're going to go back to the flyover state.
Right.
They got emptied out.
Right. So you're just to put a final point on it, your situation, your landlord come next, you had like a, did you have a 2-year renewal? Is that what it was? And then
there's 45 tenants in the building.
Uh-huh. And then the next renewal, he or she can raise it 18% again.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow. That is nasty.
Yeah. I mean, there's many people like me who are paying much more than half their income on rent.
Right. Sure.
And you're only supposed to spend, you know, you're not supposed to pay more than a quarter.
That is a very old model, I have to say.
I mean, it's a model
cities.
That works for like having a good living. You know,
yeah,
having
exactly.
A good life,
right.
You know? I don't know what the point of being an artist is unless you're having a good life. I mean, obviously we have many examples of artists who've had miserable lives, but somehow, you know, that helped their art in some way, maybe. Who knows?
Were you ever in a situation?
In general.
Were you ever in a situation where you had the opportunity to at least consider a buy, a purchase of a place?
No, I come from a family that was probably, in terms of capital within the immediate family, lower middle class with upper class sort of memories and pretensions. Decidedly, there was no capital. There was never any capital. I actually did buy a little house upstate after a very good year, and I found a little. But it's really a cottage,
mm-hmm.
you know, on an interesting little piece of property. And even the cottage is a money pit. You know, every
no
time
kidding.
I have these maple trees on the property, and one is quite sick, and it could run as much as like $25,000 to $30,000 to take it down.
Jeez,
then you might be able to find like a handyman type guy up there who'll take it down for like a couple of thou.
Right.
But it's they're few and far between. But in a really good tree service, it'll cost a lot of money to take it down. It's like, and you know, like who's got, you know, I just there's a statistic out that something like 63% or 57%, I think it's like 63% of Americans, if they had a $1,000 emergency expenditure, it would break them.
Right.
And fortunately, you know, I've been fortunate, and that wouldn't break me, but a sudden $20,000 expenditure would probably cause severe problems.
Absolutely.
You know?
When you had that really good year that allowed you to purchase this cottage, what proportion of that was sales, or what was the big difference that year?
Well, I draw a pretty good salary as a professor at Rutgers, and I had a show that was fairly successful. So
mm-hmm.
I would say that sales were all of a sudden a significant. Well, they probably amounted to like close somewhere between a third and a half of my income.
Mm-hmm.
Two fifths of my income.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, so that's a big boost.
And all of a sudden, you know, it was just a sudden influx, and it created a down. And I'd been saving over, you know, I'm not young, nor am I old. I'm sort of like the ghost of Christmas past, young
right.
and old at the same time.
Right, right.
So I had the money to buy, put it down on it, and then I had fantasies of continued success.
So when you had that really good sales show, what year was that, by the way?
That was 2011-12.
2011-12. So when you had that show...
Yeah, when I just come back from the Rome Prize.
Okay. So you had a lot of momentum in your sales.
I had momentum, and the show had all these great reviews.
Right.
So
the question here then is, what were your expectations for the subsequent shows that you had over the next few years?
I wouldn't call them expectations. I would call them like fantasies that become persuasive.
Right.
In some way.
Interesting choice of words. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that would continue.
Yeah.
I thought that,
who wouldn't?
We were coming out. Remember, we were coming out of the Great Recession Depression.
Quote unquote coming out of it. Yeah.
Yeah, quote unquote coming out, and it seemed that obviously I'd had these good reviews, and my gallerist Jill is one of the nicest people in the art world and great to talk to, but it's really it's not an international gallery, my subsequent show was also very successful, but it's just the periods in between, and it just doesn't add up compared to 20% increase, 18-20% increases in rent every couple of years.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So you're
sort of describing a model in which an artist, in this case you, is being productive and having consistent shows and selling pretty well. But the inference, though, is to be an artist that's supporting the ownership of a place or the rental of a nice place in the city depends on sort of an ongoing production in which there are two shows a year or something like that.
Well, the thing that's presumed to be a constant there is that rents rise reasonably compared to historical levels. But what New York is experiencing, it's something like, it's very akin to what San Francisco is experiencing.
Right.
In New York City, is particularly Brooklyn and Manhattan, south of 83rd Street on the east side, they're basically what everybody's experiencing is an unprecedented increase in rental rates. A housing shortage that's inflated by New York becoming really a kind of global destination in a way that it really wasn't. It's always been America's global city, but you have global real estate concerns, and there's a lot of apartment warehousing.
The shell game, as I like to call it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of luxury rent. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday, which I have not read, but I'm told the gist of it is that the luxury market is now topping out with all these high rises, these obscene high rises that are taller than the Empire State Building and casting shadows on Central Park.
Right.
This is also happening in downtown Brooklyn.
Mm.
You can Zillow places and you can find, easily find like $11,000 a month, $17,000 a month. I saw a $27,000 a month rental in Brooklyn.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's beyond crazy. It's science fiction. It's like madness.
Yes.
And these apartments are in general not inhabited. They're often owned by corporations, and they're for people who come in occasionally.
Right.
you know, and so you've got, and now the gist of the New York Times being the you know, the daily blat of the upper, lower upper class, the upperly mobile upper middle class. So their aspirations are to sort of be like this. Everybody who is like this doesn't really have time for the New York Times and doesn't have the politics of the New York Times, which is, you know, sort of upper, upperly mobile, middle class, upper middle class liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of self-congratulatory, but, you know, ultimately destructive, you know, sort of policy behind the Times. But there's the sense that somehow in this article, supposedly, and I will read it, is that the topping out of the luxury market is good for everybody who's in, you know, middle and upper middle income rentals now, because everybody who's where we are, who can actually get out and move up, will have a place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because now the market is sort of flattening at that level,
right,
which will supposedly free space up for middle class housing.
Right.
As we all climb up the ladder, which to me sounds like so naive in relationship to late model laissez faire capitalism, as to almost, you know, be a joke.
Well, I was going to say it sounds like a tiny, tiny window of optimism, but one that probably doesn't have its footing yet.
Clap louder. But, you know,
right.
I guess, you know, a lot of artists are moving to L.A.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. Yes, they're...
What's that going to do besides the temporary increase in good coffee houses?
Right. It's become... L.A. is going to become a giant Williamsburg. Yeah, exactly. So...
There used to be a website called Look at That Fucking Hipster. You know about this website?
Was it really called Look at... Because I actually had a guest on my show called Accidental Chinese Hipsters. But no, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of the one you're talking about.
Then there was like a kind of website sort of devoted to sort of porn. And it was like, Look at That Fucking Hipster Fucking. Something like that. It did get very meta.
Right. Right. Okay.
But,
well,
you know, LA.
Yeah. Go ahead.
LA has hipsters.
Sure. Every major city has hipsters, of course. You know, and we could get into a long debate over exactly what that means, which I don't think would be very interesting. But I guess the implication in this context has something to do with people who are overflowing the artist neighborhoods, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. I usually think it means like a kind of soul patch on your lower lip.
That's a little reductive, but maybe.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little reductive, but
I mean,
round glasses.
Right.
With the soul patch.
Well, for me, it's more like really, really big, chunky glasses and a hat. Is more the sort of cliche hipster that comes to mind for me. But anyway.
Yeah, in July, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well,
you mentioned... Well,
I don't know.
Oh, are you still on this train?
Yeah. Well, no. I can get off this train.
Okay.
It probably doesn't end well.
Yeah.
It's not gonna end well for anybody.
Exactly. It might not end well. Well, the thing that I wanted to... One of the sort of key probes that I wanted to... put towards you has to do with, and you made a very alliterative statement earlier, and is that you are an artist and have been a writer, and from my perception, which you can help me sort of clarify, because I'm sure I have a little bit of misperception about it, you were both at one point a critic and a painter, and I had a perception that, you know, not having being out here for a while, and I was aware of you when I was in New York myself. But the perception that you were able to at one point give up the writing because your art had become so successful. So maybe you can sort of clarify what the arc of those two things is.
Wow, that's a great story.
Uh huh.
I don't want to bust anybody. I don't want to, you do things for love, don't you? I mean, I was a desultory literature major when I showed up at UC Santa Barbara.
From the Bay Area, by the way, right?
Yeah. I grew up in the Bay Area. It's very roundabout. I was actually born in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
My father worked for GE. He was a madman. He became a madman.
Mm-hmm.
Because GE was the PR department was the big feeder to Madison Avenue, and but they hated the weather. They were from California, and so when I was three, we drove back to first LA and then San Francisco. When my father worked for Footcone and Belding, which was a big national agency, but they had a branch in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote copy for them, basically, for many years. And
what town did you grow up in? In the city itself or outside?
I grew up in the city. Yeah.
What neighborhood?
What year?
No. What neighborhood in San Francisco?
Well, first Park Merced, and then St. Francis Wood.
Neither of those are on my radar, I'm afraid, and I've been there
many
times.
Well, they're on the south side of Twin Peaks, so where the trains come out, where the subway, not a subway, the streetcars come out of West Portal. At Upper Market, they go into Twin Peaks, into the tunnel.
Yeah.
They come out on the other side of West Portal, and the neighborhood just on the left coming out on the other side of Portola, which is the street that goes over the hill and turns into Market.
Right.
That's called St. Francis Wood, and it's an old homestead.
Oh, beautiful up there.
It's beautiful. Inlaid sidewalks.
Mm.
There was a time when houses weren't expensive. You know, my father didn't have a lot of money, but friends loaned him money, and he bought a house there. And I would, I was 12, I think, 66. We had been in Park Merced, which, as you know, is like Park La Brea.
Mm.
It was at the time, it was the same company, Metropolitan Life, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right by San Francisco State.
When was the last time? When was the last time you visited San Francisco? By the way,
well, my father's still alive, and so I was just there in January.
Okay, because I want to know how the city left an impression on you this time around. Because last time I was there, I'll just say as a way of introduction, it started to feel like it was changing quite a bit, and this was a couple years ago now.
Well, you could feel the stress that everybody's under in the same way that you can feel the stress in Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Right.
Nobody knows what to do about the rent, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you try to move around the Bay Area to escape. My mother died in 95, and their best friends, the husband of the wife of the couple that were my parents' best friends, died a year later, and then she and my father began to keep each other company out of consolation because they'd known each other for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they wound up getting married in the early aughts, and so it's very sweet. But they live in Greenbrae now, which is a Marin little neighborhood in Marin on a little hillock.
Mm.
Up by Larkspur, so
equally Tony up there, right?
What?
Equally Tony up there as well.
No, it's actually an old. I guess it's not Tony in the way that St. Francis Wood sort of projects certain level of Tony-ness, but like really Hancock Park is like much grander than even the Wood. It's more like Roslyn Heights in Long Island. It was like Levitt Town.
Mm.
They were all like sort of Eichler type, five model, modernistic ranch style houses.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way they weren't ranches was when they went down a hillside.
Mm-hmm.
But the top is still like a kind of ranch. It's very lateral. They let a lot of light in. A lot of cinder block and wood modernism, kind of post-war modernism. And it was a development like that so the houses were very middle class, actually.
Right.
And but because they're houses and because all the landscaping has grown up over 70 years, I guess now it's expensive. But everything's expensive.
Sure.
Let's
get jump off this train. I mean, this is a great train, and it will probably end well. But I think we need to allow plenty of time for the myth.
To talk about the art.
To talk about the myth that I created for you and your pairing
of
careers.
Becoming so fabulously successful as a painter that I could like throw down the pen and say never more.
Exactly.
But that didn't happen. I was a literature major. I was a literature major. I went to college. I didn't know I was going to be an artist.
Wow.
And that's another story. But I always knew that I was going to write in some way. I never knew I was going to paint, which it didn't mean I didn't love painting. And I actually probably do feel more like a human being as a painter than a writer, both of which are things we do in isolation and are not very, ultimately not very social until we have an opening.
Right.
And then it's like so terrifying we go back to our lairs.
Right.
But
how did you?
I knew that.
I'm sorry.
I was writing. I was a literature. I still write reviews now because it's just a way to write.
Right.
But I don't. I write less because it takes. I write catalog essays. Sometimes they're for friends. Sometimes they're for museums, and they're fairly remunerative, as writing goes.
Oh, interesting.
And I still write I still write like an essay a year for Art in America.
Mm-hmm.
This year may be a really. I might even write two.
Wow.
Because I just wrote this one on Torres Garcia, Joaquin Torres Garcia, such an interesting artist and sort of a pivotal figure in Latin American modernism. And there was, of course, and it's easy. It's like by easy, I mean, every artist is a very rich topic that gets handed to a writer like me who writes about shows that come up. Because the art is so interesting, and then there's also the topicality of the show, and that creates the pressure of the deadline that also makes sure that I actually finish the piece. And
it really sounds like you're enjoying the writing about these either artists or shows.
Well, yeah, I enjoy writing about work that I like. I don't like writing about work I don't like.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't feel like I have to take on anything, like I'm going to take this down because this person's getting away with murder.
Right.
There are people who love that challenge. It feels bilious inside me. For other people, I think it actually can be a very noble calling.
Right.
But, I get to write. I get to explore in depth about why am I interested in this? Or why does this call to me? And it's also my work is not narrow within its strictures, but people would say it's fairly it's kind of post minimalism that depends on a certain pop geometry irony about doubleness and perception. All that's like very, and it's very, so it's serial and it's one kind of work, and it comes maybe out of a relationship to architecture, but I get to write about work that's not like mine.
Right.
And in some cases I get to write about work that is like mine.
The thing that I'm interested in above most of that is how you've been perceived or how you think you've been perceived in terms of being a writer of art. I don't know. I guess you've never been called a critic per se, but certainly an art writer.
Have called me a critic. I guess writing about something you love, if it's interesting, can be called a form of criticism.
Right.
But I think the most interesting quote critics end quote are people like poets who actually really love painting.
Mm.
They're not worried about painting's relationship to capitalist production and how it's a sign of decadence. They fall into painting in a kind of reverie. And I have that relationship to painting and painting. So painting, I love painting because I became a painter because I love painting. And it does certain things, and I can talk about what it does in my writing. But I can talk about it through other artists. So I can talk about it through visual matrices that are not my own.
So it sounds like you're advocating for the critic who is able to write about painting and embraces painting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that that's kind of a... I don't think it's too much of a stretch of an analogy to talk about the podcaster who enjoys a certain conversation and seeks to create a kind of climate so those conversations are fostered.
Right. Well,
we can
make this analogy then, since we haven't quite gotten there yet, which is, it sounds like you've really embraced, or at least at the very least, been quite comfortable. The shoes have fit well of being an artist who writes, or being a writer who makes art, or however it is. I just wonder if at some point you perceived that, Stephen Westfall, he's that, he has a show, he's that critic who paints.
I'm sure that has happened, and sometimes I'm worried about it or obsessed about it.
Mm-hmm.
Other times I don't really care all that much. It often depends on how I'm feeling about other things in my life.
Mm. Can you give me an example?
Self-consciousness and anxiety. The knee bone is connected to the shin bone, and it's so. If I'm going through a breakup over here, I'm going to feel anxious over there.
Right.
Or if I'm really happy about something over here, I'm going to feel like set free over there. Not that it's not all temporary, because it's all temporary. But
right.
Things change and everything's relational.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do it any other way. What happened was I became, there was this college within UC Santa Barbara called the College of Creative Studies, and my roommate Stephen White was in it, and it looked like a model for going through school based on self-motivation and a kind of support for unflagging interest and set free of the kind of grade chasing that the rest of college education in the country, including inevitably at UCSB, was set up as. It was pass no credit,
right.
Not pass fail, was pass no credit. Mm. So you could, if you did no work in a class you took, you got no credit. You didn't fail.
Right.
And there was, and so what happened was, it was, we were encouraged to take classes like, I took a painting class, and my first teacher was Paul Warner in a painting class. Like, Paul Warner was like, one of the members of the Bay Area Figurative School, and a beautiful guy, and very sweet, a very sweet man. And, so I was like taking, painting, foundation from like Bonnard, basically.
Right.
Of course you're going to and not worrying about the grade. And this was even while I was waiting to know whether I got in. And, I was like writing, basically melancholy poems about not getting what I wanted. So they sort of, they said, well, we think your poetry, I was applying as a literature major.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we think you have talent as a writer. It's there and we'll take you. But have you thought about being a painter?
Mm.
Because obviously you really love painting.
Yeah.
No, I had never thought, I didn't even know that you were allowed to be a, obviously you were allowed because they had it in college, but I didn't think you'd be actually, nobody in my family, no, that had never happened, So I became a double major, literature and studio art major as an undergraduate, and involved a lot of writing, a lot of reading. It was kind of like, there was so much reading. It was like that whole thing in Oxford, where they give you just a stack of books that you can't see over, and you're supposed to read them all by next week and come back in with a kind of piece of writing about them. And that's kind of the way the college was.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, it was 24/7 access to the studio, which at that, in that era, you know, this was the early 70s, like nobody had 24-hour access to the studio. You had to get a key, and they closed up at 11 or something. So we'd be there all night, like drinking wine, you know, literally arguing about art because everybody was so, you know, self-motivated. And there were a lot of New Yorkers. And, you know, I had been a New Yorker when I was like two, but I had never seen a grown-up one.
Mm.
And they were my college roommates, and everybody was like super intense and funny and you know,
what were they
involved with this
what
thing.
Were they doing at UC Santa Barbara?
A lot of them came out because of the College of Creative Studies.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
Which was this funny little magnet.
Right.
It still persists. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's pretty, you know, at the time they were always trying to shut it down. Because there was a, you know, it's like, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris, you know? I mean, obviously, it's kind of anarchistic. If you're going through school and you're trying to, you know, you're in a class of like 500 people, and you know, like in Western Civ or something, and you're trying to eke out like a B plus on your Blue Book test, and then you look over at the college, which is in this these old barracks,
right.
Which I think used to be the home ec when it was like a state teacher's school. And you're looking at the college, and their classes are like eight people, and everybody's talking about Jane Austen with the teacher in a conversation,
right?
As opposed to being lectured at. Well, you know, you're going to want that.
Yeah, you're going to want that, absolutely. When did let me change gears here for a second. When did the abstraction start for you?
Okay, so that's a great question, and it came fairly rapidly. So my first two teachers were Paul Warner and Hank Pitcher, and Hank is sort of very talented. At that time, he was very, I would say, he was getting a lot from looking at Alex Katz, and he became a sort of a well-known sort of T-coat landscape and painter of surfers, of surfer culture,
mm-hmm.
with this kind of Tebow meets Alex Katz sort of flat chromatic planes that resonated with each other. He's great, and he also looked at a lot of Bonnard. He's great for like painting shadow as light, and it's kind of crisp but fluid style that owes a lot to the people I've just mentioned. And he came after, some of the LA minimalists were brought up, like David Trowbridge, who since died, becomes one that hardly anybody remembers, but John McCracken too.
John McCracken people will recognize.
Yeah. So David had a big influence on me, and we all went down to hear Agnes Martin speak in 73 at, the Pasadena Museum of Art, which then became the Norton Simon Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pasadena Museum at that time was sort of run by Robert Rowland, who was a big L.A. collector. There's this wonderful book out called Out of Sight, which is a great history of L.A. art, which describes that time. Like, they couldn't get it together to form a stable museum of art. The battles between the collectors and, you know, so Rowland had this sort of advanced New York collection of art. And Pasadena, he had this museum in Pasadena that he was building up. And the Pasadena, as a community, just basically wasn't interested. So this is one of the last gasps of that era before Norton Simon, who was a much more conservative guy, took it over. And so Agnes Martin hadn't painted for like 6 years. And she was just coming back into painting. And the show was circulating, and it was kind of the show that where she really crossed over. I heard her speak, and she was introduced by a 22-year-old or 23-year-old Barbara Haskell, who was wearing a miniskirt and black leotards. And everybody knew, the rumor was already that she was moving to New York, and she went on to become like, you know, the great sort of curator of early American modernism at the Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
And the show itself was mesmerizing, and I had my first flash. Some people have it when they see Barnett Newman, and for me it was Agnes Martin, because, you know, some of her paintings are 6 feet square and some of her paintings are like 12 inches square, and I saw that they were the same thing, that they that their internal scale was such that the 12-inch square painting could command proportionally the same amount of space around it as a 6-foot square painting.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was is that they turned, they became, even though they were about like sort of like open spaces and measured intervals and a kind of freedom of movement in those measured intervals that was akin to music and to like flat landscape. You know, she grew up on the plains of Western Canada. They were also figures in those, by being squares, they were, you know, sort of perfect geometric forms. They were figures against the field of the wall, or more broadly, the field of architecture, of real architecture. So they were like events and breaks in the architecture of the room of the that, you know, that the viewer was in. So in looking at them, I would say a sensitive viewer would become more aware of her or his surrounding.
Mm-hmm.
While looking into the painting at the same time. So there were, you know, the sort of the perceptual paradox of painting as thing and imagined space simultaneously was felt very strongly by me in looking at abstract work.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that the more that there was a narrative image in the work, the more it became about the space and the less it became inside the painting and the less it became about the space outside the painting and the painting's own thingness. And I wanted that simultaneity.
Mm.
And that paradoxical sort of flashing back and forth. I didn't have a language for saying that then.
Right.
I just knew that what I saw wasn't how humble a painting could be.
Hmm.
That a painting could be, that a painting didn't have to have a lot going on in it to have a kind of presence.
So that was basically, when it comes down to it, the takeaway that, even if you couldn't articulate it at the time, that led you there and to stay strong enough to stay there for decades.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, simultaneously, I was, you know, I felt very insecure. I loved art. You know, I, even growing up as a kid in San Francisco, you know, I knew what modern art was. I wasn't like disconnected from it. It was the 60s. We would get stoned a lot, and I would sort of drift off from the group and take the streetcar down to SF MoMA, which at the time was in the Civic Center. And I would look at, you know, big abstract paintings, and, you know, and I was a miserable kid, partly, which baffles me today, but because, you know, San Francisco is a beautiful place to be at this time. And of course the weather is great, and I grew up in beautiful neighborhoods, but I had tremendous anxiety over many, many things. And I think that, you know, a lot of it had to do with the Vietnam War. I think I was being a boy, sort of feeling like your future was going to be curtailed by the war.
Hmm.
So the more caught up with current events any of us were, and I read the newspaper every day, even as a teenager or even an adolescent, the more anyone was aware of current events, the more freaked out we all got. And so I didn't know what I wanted to do at all, you know, because I didn't think I had a future. It was also compulsory service. So I was a pretty ungovernable as a kid, just, you know, basic. I'm dyslexic. I have like all those issues. And even though I read really well, I actually learned to read because of dyslexia rather than in spite of it, because I learned to read for voice.
Mm.
I heard a voice in the text,
mm.
which a lot of people have said that's how I write. I write for, they hear a voice when they read me, which is, you know, probably, you know, a crossover. There was all that plus the current events going on, like all the anxieties of being hyperactive but I'd go down to the San Francisco Museum of Art and I'd see a big Gene Davis, for like in the atrium space of the old War Memorial Opera House. And I'd say, I don't know what I want to do, but if I could choose about what I want to do, that's what I would want to do.
Hmm.
You know, I would, you know, and of course the kid can sort of imagine, when we, as kids, we imagine being an adult. What we really imagine is like we're just big kids doing adult things.
Hmm.
We don't think we're going to have wrinkles. We don't think we're going to, like, you know, ever have a colonoscopy.
Right.
Like, I'm a kid, really, I don't know who Gene Davis is, but I see this painting, and I go, I project myself into being a big kid in some garage making stripe paintings, you know, with tape.
Right.
Going like, yeah. And that looked great. And the thing was like, it was a painting that they still have. It's called Cool Buzzsaw. And it's a great, in my imagination, it was like 10 feet square, but it's probably about 8 feet square.
Mm-hmm. So you've been making abstract paintings for how many years, would you say, roughly?
Well, I would say since I was a junior.
Wow. Okay. So we're talking 30, 40 years.
Yeah. Thank you for the 30. But
sorry. Yeah. Let's say
more like 40 years.
Let's say 30 some years.
Yeah. 30 plus.
Okay. 30 plus. Perfect.
Yeah.
It's not to date you or anything like that. I just want
because far be it.
Yeah. Exactly.
One of my
ongoing stock questions on the show with guests is, what do you think about the explosion of abstraction, particularly in the marketplace? And I know, as just an additional preface to that, that you have seen it on both sides, you know, quite thoroughly. I'm sure there have been patches where, and maybe I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, where abstraction felt very unfashionable and painting felt very unfashionable and retro and whatnot. So, yeah, let's go back just to the question itself. What do you think about abstraction and its explosion, particularly in the marketplace?
I think everything sort of exploded in the marketplace for those artists lucky enough to strike oil.
Okay.
You know, is Marlene Dumas an abstract painter?
No.
Not really.
No, she's a figurative painter.
Gerhard Richter is between. Marc Grosjean is getting more figurative by the day.
I hear you. I think you're maybe taking it a little more literally or semantically than I intended, which is that there are a lot more people making abstract paintings over the last.
But there's a lot more people making paintings.
That's true.
You know.
That's
yeah,
true.
I mean, I'm complicit in this. I'm a professor at a graduate school. You know,
so you are you cranking them out there?
we're pumping them out like the way Catholics pump out babies. Actually, they're both really exclusive programs. Both Bard and Rutgers are very exclusive programs, and they're very small. They're very conversation driven and ethically driven, I think, because, you know, we talk about the freedom to fail as being part of the right of being an artist and, you know, not the marketplace, but the students happen to be, you know, inevitably really good, and they go on and they're very community driven. So there's a, you know, a Rutgers, Bard, Columbia, Yale sort of community, which is inevitable, and they support each other.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them become even, you know, remuneratively successful, very short order. We don't know how that's going to sustain itself for any individual, because it comes and it goes. For some people, for other people, it just comes. But it's fewer. You know, the more up the ladder you go. Amy Silman, for instance, is a painter who is like between abstraction and figuration, but you can really see the figuration in her work.
Sure.
And I think what's really interesting is that there's a lot of struggle around that, and the paintings are, in Amy's and other people's work, are kind of, you know, Charlene von Heil. You know, what is it? You know, what are these? You know, this question of the element that stays in a painting being indicative of a figure and a director of a space that becomes, you know, figurative again. You know,
I guess maybe I need to sort of put it another way, because it is more a literal kind of abstraction. So if you prefer maybe a formalist abstraction or a new formalist or a mannerist abstraction, I think
there's a thing that Walter Robinson called zombie formalism something.
Yes, exactly.
Which is also, I think, you know, I always like the idea of unhinged formalism. Well, I think there's a lot to explore there. I mean, the Big Bang creates the universe. And for 5 centuries of painting, the universe is representational in the sense of necessarily so, because painting's at the service of various narratives, and the narratives have to be represented. And by the time it gets around to the artists sort of writing their own narrative, sooner or later, 4 or 5 artists are going to get the idea almost simultaneously, so it's going to feel like a zeitgeist, that the narrative can be about painting itself. You know, so Kandinsky sort of wakes up out of a nap in Munich and sees his painting, sees a painting that's actually sideways and can't recognize anything in it. He did it. And he thinks, wow, that painting looks really great. It looks like painting set free.
Mm-hmm.
And Malevich sweats out cubism in the space of like a year and gets to this point where there's nothing left except a black square.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even Picasso, you know, while he's like sort of creating cubism, you know, does a couple of drawings of the guitar where there's in a bottle where there's like basically a, you know, 3 lines, and they all sort of see that they all of a sudden it's another Big Bang, you know. And what happened, it takes a while for all that to gain momentum. You know, how much was left unexplored in post-cubism, you know, and how much post-cubism is there in, say, mid-20th century abstraction running through contemporary Frank Stella?
Right.
You know,
yeah, I hear you. I'm sure I have to interject, because you're describing an arc of essentially painting / formalism or formalist painting.
Brought up the word formalism.
Yeah,
so that's
I did.
So anyway, so what I'm saying is that forms are proliferating,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, they're not. What I think is interesting is that as they're proliferating, they're coming back to being figurative forms, because they start off being in a semantic or semiotic sort of way figures against the field, those forms, you know. But then we start seeing that figures create spaces that are actually more reminiscent of figural space than we originally assumed. You know, a lot of Charlene's paintings where she's collaging fragments from like decorative patterns she finds in a Doofy painting with broad flat planes, they wind up sort of feeling like interiors.
I hear what you're saying, and, you know, and I could get into that kind of exploration and language, but from, you know, from a more macro perspective, you're talking about the exploration of forms in painting, essentially. And so what my sort of question that I'm trying to get you to address is more, you know, you described it as like the Big Bang is still being...
The answer that you want me to give... No, I'm kidding. What?
The Big Bang is still being explored, or still falling out from the Big Bang of painting in the early 20th century.
Yeah, so there's more abstract painters because there's more things to paint abstractly.
Okay, how?
It could be like a chicken in the chicken and egg idea.
Huh.
Well, because you know, it's sort of like shark's teeth. You make a, you do something, you know, you like between every tooth in a shark's mouth, there's another row with teeth between those teeth.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, there's another row with teeth between all of those teeth. You know, you, the more things you have, the more spaces you have between things.
I see.
And the more spaces you have to fill.
Right.
the more complicated conversation gets. So the Big Bang starts off as a singularity.
Right, right.
But
interesting.
At this point, it's no longer a singularity, except that in all the sort of the infinite proliferation of form, we're still living inside that singularity, but we're not even aware of it.
Okay. Okay, no, I hear you. That's pretty interesting. But I guess here's another angle then, another macroscopic angle. What if that conversation that is so, you know, that has so much around so many different opportunities, as you're describing it in the shark's teeth, what if that conversation ultimately is a very insular conversation that does not extend beyond the insularity of the proper art world?
Well, I guess that just depends on how much you love, say we're talking about painting, because we could be talking about some kind of sculpture too, perhaps, or a slow moving video or something, animation that sort of between, that has similar formal issues, but with the added dimension of time. I don't know. It depends on how much, you know, some days I wake up, I have no empathy for this process whatsoever.
Okay, talk about that for
a
moment.
And I think that everybody's a loser, and yes, we're all barking up the wrong tree. We should really be, what, in bands? I don't know. I think, you know, it's like we sometimes, painting is a really weird process, is a really weird thing. Painting is kind of like Obama. And here's how painting's like Obama.
Okay.
It's like, we ask more of painting than we ask almost of, and paintings are mute. They're like single thing, you know, but painting is supposed to somehow reflect Western civ and speak to either the emancipation of the artist or the artist's slavery to late capitalism as a cultural producer in ways that we never ask, like say a music composer.
Right.
Or that we never ask, a dancer.
I think what you're doing is you're concocting the painter's defense, basically, and I'm not necessarily.
Well, No. What I'm saying is that some days I'm all about. I completely agree. And other days I'm just in love with painting and what it does.
Right.
And it comes back to that thing that only painting does, which is it's an imagined space and a thing at the same time.
Yeah. It's not that.
If any viewer has empathy, like it's an empathy, you know, what Coleridge called a willing suspension of disbelief.
Right.
Some days I'm not willing.
Right.
Other days, the willing suspension of disbelief is there, which is, you know, the requirement for reading fiction or reading poetry. It's also a requirement for looking at painting.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And when it's not, when I'm not willing, I've either looked at too many paintings. And I need to stop looking at paintings for a while. But, you know, this never happens to me, by the way, when I'm in Rome. There's something about, like, looking at, or in Italy, there's like, something about, like, looking at 15th century frescoes that, for me, never gets old. For some people, it gets old.
Well, certainly when you get out,
you see if it's remoteness.
Certainly when
also,
you get out of your compadres or the New York art world or whatever, you know, you're going to have a fresh perspective on life. So in that sense,
yeah. But yeah. So I don't know. It's and there's something exhausting about, like, you know, okay, it's the first week of March. Here we go with all the March shows. You know,
yeah.
3,000 galleries in New York, and you've got to. You're not a good citizen if you are even a good friend if you haven't seen, you know, your share of them, and everybody's out of the, you know, openings become really sticky businesses because you know, you say hello to people as though you haven't seen them last week. It's like, oh, it's so great to see you. Last week, like two nights ago. And there was I went through a very sad breakup, like, in the art world, like, you know, and it led to my getting sober and all the stuff, like, years ago. Like, and I didn't go to openings for 10 years because I just didn't want to be, and it was a very productive time, but at the same time, it was so wonderful going back to openings. And I'm really good friends with my ex.
Who is your ex, if you don't mind my asking?
What?
Who is your ex, if you don't mind my asking?
a sculptor named Jill Levine, wonderful artist. But I couldn't go out. And at that time we weren't on the best of terms, you know, it was just painful. It wasn't that we weren't on, you know, it was just painful. But, you know, now we see each other, we sort of squeal like kids in a sandbox. But it was kind of great taking, you know, it was like, oh, Steve, he doesn't go to opening. But you know what's weird? It's like, you don't go to, it's like, there was a while where I had a persona of being the guy or one of the guys who are and gals who don't go to opening. It's like the art world is so, the, you know, there's like, you can do nothing. I mean, really nothing. And a legend will grow up around that.
Right.
If you're at all social at all. And maybe that was because I was a writer too.
Yeah.
So that I had this other thing. I had this persona built around a byline and a voice. That has never ceased to surprise me or kind of amaze me. But we're all like that. I remember I had one girlfriend who like there's this place called Lupe's East LA Kitchen. For the longest time, it was before like the sort of the much more advanced cuisines came in. It was the only place to get like remotely passable Sonoran Los Angeles Mexican food. And I was dating somebody once and she said, oh yeah. I used to look for you at Lupe's. They told me you could be found there, which I thought was the funniest, like, turn of phrase, like,
right.
Oh yeah, he can be found there.
Yeah.
With his six gun on the table or something, his spurs hung up, you know, at Lupe.
I think that's an excellent place to wrap things up. I hope you don't feel like we had too much blows in our debate over abstraction / formalism / painting.
Oh no! I could have gone on. I mean,
I think we need to have a part two.
It's gonna be like,
yeah,
it's gonna be, yeah. We didn't talk about your painting, I really like.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Steven, thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It was really a pleasure. I didn't think we were disagreeing at all. I mean, we were disagreeing at some points, but I thought it was all elevated and friendly. And,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we will, and if enough listeners clamor for it, we will have a part two on this particular topic alone, like an addendum.
Yeah, all right. Anticipate the clamor.
Exactly.
All right, that's great.
And
a real pleasure. I know I'm not going to get to sleep till very late tonight because I'll be thinking all about.
Good. Well, I want to hear your thoughts
when
we have follow up emails. I want to hear your post thoughts. Thank you again, Stephen. Have a
wonderful
good night,
Michael. Take care. Real
you too.
Pleasure.
You too. Me too.
All
take
right.
care. Bye bye. Thank you very much again to Stephen Westfall. I have to say he had a lot of enthusiasm considering that it was well past midnight when we concluded that call. And as he said, he was going to be up for a while. So he really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I appreciate having him on. Now, don't go away. A couple of other things I want to let you know before we go. One is, about Dan Colon, who I mentioned earlier. I heard him recently on, and this goes into the category of artists on NPR or artists in audio form. New segment of this show. I heard him on a radio show the other day, and Dan Colon, in case you don't know, is a super artist. That is sort of a rising superstar artist. He shows with Gagosian, and I assume he has a big what's called studio, you know, with many assistants and whatnot. Anyway, he of the bird shit paintings, the graffiti on fake rocks, and more recently of these Fantasia paintings. He is in a show somewhere, at Marfa, and so he was on this radio show about that and his work in general, and he acquitted himself quite well, I have to say. The reason that I brought him up, though, is because I don't know what your perceptions of artists are before you hear them is, but because of his work, I guess I expected a bit of a jokester, you know, maybe comedy, funny kind of guy or something along those lines. But no, he was very earnest in this conversation. And he acquitted himself well, like I said, but it was a little odd to hear him. And I would be open to having him on this show if you happen to know him. So feel free to put us in touch if you do. All right. Please don't go away. I wanted to thank you for listening to this show, for sending me emails, tweets, messages on Facebook, reviews on iTunes, all of which, by the way, you can do through theconversationpod.com/support. I wanted to also remind you that this is a listener-supported show. There are no advertisements. And now that this show is weekly, 20-plus hours a week go into the production and dissemination of this podcast. And so your financial and social support help the show keep going. Currently, we are trying to raise approximately $600 to $800 to, let's call it $750, to fund a transfer to a new hosting service called Libsyn, which is the industry standard for podcasts, and it'll provide better tech support, more access to our archive. And so any modest donation from $10 or $12 or ideally more that you can make would be greatly appreciated, and hopefully to give you a little extra motivation. Sarah Kane, a recent very popular guest, very popular artist on this show, gave a substantial donation herself because she believes in the show and she recognizes the challenges putting out a podcast. So I will leave you with that. Thank you so much for listening and supporting the show in any way that you can. It's all very much appreciated. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.